February 14th is not just about Valentine's. It's also the anniversary of one of the bloodiest gang confrontations in U.S. history. 1929, St. Valentine's Day Massacre occurred in Chicago. This was perhaps the culmination of prohibition and competition to serve illicit alcohol to thirsty Chicagoans. Join us today on An Incomplete History. So, second attempt at recording this episode, huh?
Yeah, I think we got like 10 minutes into the last time.
Well, it's, you know, it was the mob. They
could have been.
They put a hit out on the internet.
Yeah, and now I'm sitting alone in an office. in a secure location.
In a secure location. It was meant to be a Valentine's Day episode, but it's also a good follow-up to our Prohibition episode, right?
Yeah, definitely. Because I don't think that we got to cover some of the stuff that we'll definitely cover this week. So it is kind of an addendum to last week, but then also it's in the mood for February. It doesn't have to be the 14th.
So before we kind of drop into this, how's the weather out in Mississippi, Hillary?
Well, it's national news, Jeffrey.
I know. Do you live near the Pearl River?
So that's down in Jackson. That's about 2.5 hours from where I live. But a lot of the rivers, a lot of the places around here that, you know, get full of water, like there's like reservoirs and rivers and all that kind of stuff, like they're really, really high right now. So just today I was driving through this neighborhood. So there's this neighborhood that has really, really nice houses. And there's one house in the neighborhood that's like $200,000 cheaper than all the other houses. And I'm just like, what's going on here? It's a really nice house. Well, it turns out that like it floods all the time. So it's
mystery like, solved.
Mystery solved. So I actually drove by that neighborhood today. Just like I was just happened to be in the area and I went and looked and like, oh, it's like really, really close. And I feel so bad for the people who live there. Like, I don't think it's funny, but it is, you can see like, oh yeah, the water is going to come in at any time now. And I know that they're working on trying to like mitigate that, but you know, we've had so much rain the past 2 months, and in this month it seems like it's rained every single day. So the ground is just really wet and we can't really take much more, but it's going to rain tomorrow. So
fun times.
That's what's going on. Yeah. Nothing's happening.
Our weather's
there,
really
yeah?
boring. it's just standard San Diego weather. 70s during the day, 50s, high 40s at night. Kind of
just a light jacket.
Yeah. Well, no, for us, please. It's like parka,
heavy,
like ski
heavy
suit,
coat.
Boots. You know, blizzard preparations. So, I mean, let's start off with kind of a quick narrative of this event. And
are we calling it an event?
Well, I mean, we start by looking at the event, right? And then we kind of spiral out from that event in both directions. And I think it's an interesting window for people into what historians do, right? It's like you see something, you're kind of curious about it, and it leads you to many other things. And you can do a lot with it.
Yeah, when I was researching for this episode, so again, I have to say, this isn't our specialty necessarily, but it is interesting. And it does, it spirals both ways because I was like, well, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre obviously happens on Valentine's Day. It's February 14th, 1929. But when I was doing the research for it, it was like, oh, wow, this like kind of goes back further and then it goes forward further and all that. So we can do those both things. But a little synopsis of the massacre. You ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay. February 14th, 1929. 7 members of Chicago's Northside Gang, so that's the Irish Americans, which also there are Polish Americans in Chicago's Northside Gang, are murdered by unknown individuals. There are thoughts that it is the Italian Americans, ran by Johnny Torrio and Al Capone, who were the arch nemesis of the Northside gang. So their organization, there's the Northside gang that has the Irish Americans and the Polish Americans, and then you have the Italian Americans that are known as the Chicago Outfit. So before the massacre happens, there's a lot of unrest between the two. We can go into that later. But what happens on this day is that there are seven people of the Chicago Northside gang who are murdered in a parking garage. And the folks who murdered them show up. Two of them are dressed as police officers. They usher the seven Northside gang members into this garage, line them up against a wall, and mow them down with subatomic machine guns, right?
So submachine guns, not subatomic, right?
Submachines. No, sorry. I'm bad with guns. I don't know anything about guns. They're Tommy guns. Subatomic. That I know.
Wow, that would be like. No, I think it's good. It's good. No, it's good. Shithead idiot.
Okay. Anyway, they're Tommy guns. That I do know. But they're Thompson machine. Thompson, yeah. Right?
Is what Thompson is what semi-automatic guns. And they're called Tommy guns, right?
So these four unidentified men, again, two of them dressed as Chicago Police Department, they enter this garage in the north side. They order the gang members up against the wall. They pull out the machine guns. They mow them down. There's one survivor for a couple of hours, and interestingly enough, his name is Frank Tightlips Guzenberg. He died in the hospital about 2 hours later, and he never named who shot at them. And so he kind of, you know, he went to the grave not ratting on the people who killed him and his friends. And the main target of the attack was the leader of Chicago's Northside gang, Bugs Moran. And he escaped. He wasn't there. So he leaves unharmed, and it ends up being like seven of his henchmen who were shot in this massacre. And this leads to a 5-year gang war between Capone and Moran, but it also leads to a federal crackdown on gang activity, because this happens in broad daylight. This is like in the daytime. They're like marching people out in a public space, mowing them down. It's brazen. It's a brazen attack. And so it brings a lot of attention to gang activity that's going on, but had been going on for several years. And this is all, of course, related to what we talked about last week with Prohibition and the illegal running and selling and producing of alcohol. So the gang war that ensues leads Al Capone to being labeled as public enemy number one. And so there's the federal crackdown on gang activity, but it also kind of solidifies that like Capone is the guy in charge here now. I mean, becomes this very public figure, even though he was well known prior, he's like even more so now. But this massacre happens 1929. So we know that Prohibition's been going on for a long time at that point. It's well into Prohibition.
I mean, one of the reasons they're willing to fight is this illegal trade in alcohol is very lucrative, right?
Oh my gosh, it's so lucrative. Yeah, Al Capone was making, they said, upwards of $60 million per year. $60 million from bootlegging.
In dollars. Also prostitution. In $1929. Right.
Still a lot of dollars. Yeah.
Which would be much, much more.
It would be like, a billion. Yeah. I was thinking somewhere close to that. Like, what would you even do with that amount of money?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to chew on there. Right. And I want to kind of focus on some weird stuff that just cracks me up. And then we can kind of get to maybe some of the bigger issues that you've already kind of hinted at, right? So you said it's seven members of the gang. That's true, but not quite true, correct?
Not quite.
I mean, Reinhard Schwimmer cracks me up. So he's an optician who decides to like gamble with gangsters. Well, he lost that bet.
Yeah, didn't go well. But if you're running around with gangsters,
right?
Aren't you one?
Well, he's like a thrill seeker, right? I mean, he's this guy who feels bored with life, and he's kind of a thrill seeker, and you know. So you've got him, and then you've got the mechanic. I feel bad for the mechanic. But I guess if you're a mechanic for gangsters, you know.
But that's the point. And that's really interesting that you bring it up, that like there are these people who are like, well, not really members of the gang. But like that's what, you know, I always was raised. It's like you're hanging around with gang members. You're a gang member. So don't do that. You know, I mean, not that I was, but that was always something my parents would tell me. It's like, you don't hang out with these people. You're going to get in trouble with these people. No.
Right. So Moran is the big, Bugs Moran is the target, right? And supposedly Moran is running late to the meeting. And we'll talk about what the meeting was. The meeting was the deal to get booze, right? It was this kind of shipment of high quality whiskey. And it was an all setup, right? I mean, this is pieced together after the fact. Capone never admits to this. A lot of other people kind of really resist saying much about this. But what's interesting is this idea that it's to make a deal for booze. And they've made it a large enough amount that Moran himself is going to be there. But he's running late to the meeting. And when he gets there, he already sees two of Capone's men dressed as policemen going in. He assumes it's a police raid. So he leaves. And a lot of people in the neighborhood are around the garage, you know, on North Clark Street, assumed this was the case, right? That the police had come to do this. And then the interesting thing is there's a period there where people assume the police had just massacred these gang members.
Yeah, well, it kind of looked like they had because of the disguises. And also because they knew that there was such public warfare going on between these gang members that it wouldn't have been utterly surprising for there to have been like a police shootout at this point.
Right. Yeah, I you know, I think it's funny because there are so many people who kind of hear it or see the beginning of it or the aftermath of it, and they all just assume it's part of the same, that it's this continuation of things going on. But it's not. And it's interesting because the FBI immediately kind of focuses on Al Capone, right?
Well, yeah, because there had been such, again, like a public feud between these two factions for years. And so they did zero in because it made sense. Like you said, they pieced together that there was a major meeting going on, that Bugs Moran was supposed to be there. And it just made sense that it had been planned out by Capone's Chicago outfit, because there had been such problems between these two organizations for so many years that, I mean, who else would it have been? And what's funny is, like, I think everyone knew it, but nobody was ever prosecuted.
Well, and I think it's interesting that, so what Capone had been doing was losing a lot of his shipments, his illegal shipments, to Moran's gang. I mean, it wasn't just that they were fighting each other for control of alcohol and stuff in Chicago. This filtered out across the whole Great Lake region for them. And, you know, Moran was kind of, it was an open secret that his gang was preying on Capone's shipments further north and then across the Lake Michigan in places like Detroit, right? I mean, this is all going on, and Capone does this. And Capone's an interesting character that I think we need to talk about, but I want to get to kind of what makes this case so particular and special. And I think there are a few things that do that. The first, I think, is ballistics.
Yeah, the firepower.
I mean, not only that these two submachine guns are used for this, and they use a shotgun as well, and I think they use a 45, but that the FBI uses ballistics to eventually solve the case in 1935-ish, right?
You're saying, so like there's advances in technology.
Yeah,
that
it's
allow
this,
for
well, it's
yeah,
this is,
that's
this
really,
is,
yeah, it is neat.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time that ballistics is used, and they actually recover these two guns. There's this thing that happens in Michigan. I mean, the war between Capone and Moran's gang goes on for some time. And they find these two guns and they test them, and they determine that the guns had actually been used in the massacre way back in 1929. And it's a real breakthrough for the FBI, right? I mean, it's one way gangsters had avoided being prosecuted was they always kind of had one degree of separation or 2 degrees of separation from anything that went on, right?
Right. And in this particular case, Capone wasn't even there. He wasn't even in Chicago.
He was in Florida.
He had removed himself. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was way far away. He was in Palm Island, and he just could say, hey, I was down in Florida. I don't know what you're talking
about.
Well,
and do you know whose office he was in? He was like in the Dade County Sheriff's Office or something. He had like arranged.
Yeah, no, he knew exactly.
That's
yeah.
The thing is, I think he arranged for him to get questioned by police so that he'd have an
airtight alibi. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's so we get the Capone versus Moran gangs, and they had come up with this plan. Capone's gang had come up with this plan to destroy the Moran gang entirely. I mean, this wasn't meant to just send a signal. This was meant to actually just annihilate Moran's gang. And so Capone, the eventual explanation comes out that Capone agrees to fund this plot to kill Moran and anybody around him. And he uses this guy, Jack Machine Gun McGurn. And McGurn's going to be the one to kind of carry it out. Interestingly enough, McGurn himself had been a target of Moran's gang, right? Moran's gang had tried to kill McGurn. So McGurn found out where Moran's gang kind of hung out, which was at 2122 North Clark Street. He got gunmen from outside Chicago so that they wouldn't be recognized. He also rented an apartment near the garage, set lookouts there, got a police car, got police uniforms, and then they concocted the whole story of the whiskey. So it's the whiskey. They said they had hijacked a shipment of whiskey, which Moran had already shown a proclivity to kind of buy this stuff that was hijacked from Capone. And it was old log cabin whiskey, which meant it was, you know, premium whiskey, but a really good price, about $57 a case. So the agreement was they'd bring this liquor there, they'd make the deal, and the exchange would go down and stuff. I mean, it's kind of a brilliant plan on McGurn's part, right?
Yeah, it was well orchestrated. And it had been, I think that they had been orchestrating something along these lines. I mean, this level of trying to destroy it completely for a long time. And they thought that they had succeeded because I think they said that when the people marched out into the garage, they thought that Bugs Moran was amongst those individuals because there was somebody who was like similar height, weight, dress or whatever to him. And they didn't realize until after it was all finished and Moran made a public statement that he was actually still alive. Like, oh, shoot. But it was, I mean, had he been there, then yeah, it would have been perfectly orchestrated. But they planned it for a long time. I mean, down to, the story about the alcohol and then, you know, Capone being in Florida and people coming from outside. I mean, it was a well-orchestrated attack and it was successful.
Yeah, so
In accomplishing what they wanted to accomplish, which was becoming the prominent gang.
Doesn't last very long for Capone, but
it's his downfall.
Well,
really.
That's the thing is like, so this is the thing, like the public's so outraged, the FBI kind of doubles down on its efforts. So Capone's in Miami. It was the Dade County solicitor who was questioning him. Machine Gun McGurn was with his girlfriend, his blonde girlfriend, the 13th and the 14th in a hotel room. It was called the Blonde Alibi. Burke was one of the gunmen. He was actually arrested a couple of years later on an unrelated charge and sentenced to prison. But the interesting thing is, so Burke doesn't go to jail over this. He goes to jail over something else. McGurn doesn't go to jail over this. Al Capone doesn't either, although everybody knows Al Capone and McGurn did this. Like, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, but still to this day, we can't say emphatically that they did, really. Well, nobody's ever been in trouble for it.
Right. Well, I mean, so I have a question. So why, and this is where historians, these are interesting questions, but like, we know we aren't supposed to ask them. Why doesn't Guzenberg, Frank Guzenberg, why doesn't he speak?
Because they're not rats. They don't want to talk to the police.
But it's a rival gang.
It doesn't matter. They don't. That's what's interesting about the mafia. And maybe we can go into talking about this a little bit, because I think it gets to the heart of the question. The mafia, these mafia gang whatevers, they're created by people who are immigrants. They don't trust the police. They don't trust any sort of government law enforcement entity to protect them and their communities. So they create these outfits. And I mean, this dates all the way back into the 19th century. And it doesn't matter if it's a rival or not. Nobody wants to talk to the police. And that's to this day. I mean, you know, you look at gang wars that go on all over the country. And of course, it looks completely different now. But it's a similar sentiment. You're not going to have them tell on each other, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend or something, right? What is that? Like, they have a common enemy, I guess. I mean, some saying doesn't work. They have a common enemy, and that's the police. And so they're not going to talk to the police. Never. Why would they?
So let's talk about the racial aspect of this, right? Kind of the ethnic inflection to this conflict, and because I think it cast a long shadow across how people in the United States view crime even today.
Yeah, well, I think at the time, you know, I guess we can talk a little bit about the construction of whiteness, but Italians weren't considered white at that time.
But even, right? But even the Irish, I mean, it's interesting. One gang's Irish, predominantly Irish, and some Polish people. And the other gang is predominantly Italian. And for a lot of kind of middle class white Protestant Americans, they look at this and they're like, of course. Right? They've decided in their minds, what can you expect of people that aren't like us? Because
they're immigrant communities.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's, you know, it's an interesting kind of, it's this vicious cycle. It's like, well, are there some of the people involved in kind of this gang, these criminal organizations, these gangs, are they in that because there aren't opportunities outside of them for them? I mean, there's a lot of white Protestant guys running booze as well. And,
oh, yeah.
And they aren't like going to jail like this.
Well, but I think that they're more consumers of it than they are bootleggers. Is right. that fair? And see, maybe, and that's what yeah. it is right now. I mean, if you think about the current state of affairs in the United States with gangs and drugs and all of that, like, white middle-class people are consumers of drugs, but they're not traffickers of drugs.
Right. Generally.
And so, generally.
I mean, and I think that's by design.
Of course it is. Yeah, they want to. Drug consumption in this country is like completely out of control, and we don't talk about that. We just talk about like, oh, well, who are the people trafficking it? And it's like, well, who are the people consuming it? It's a supply and demand situation right. here.
Well, and the way, I mean, we talked about in our prohibition episode, the whole problem with one of the issues with the prohibition laws is it doesn't ban the consumption.
Yeah, that's the most convenient loophole. I think that that's kind of like the funniest part of all of that. It's like, it doesn't say anything about drinking it. It just says stuff about
producing
about
it,
selling it, and producing it. It doesn't say anything about drinking it. I love that. Yeah. I think that that's very American.
I don't know how you got it, but you can go ahead and drink it now that you have it. It's so, I mean, it really does. I mean, it's a system that's designed to punish those who are providing the vice or feeding the vice.
I mean, I think that there's a similarity to what's happening here. I mean, right now, I guess not here, but right now, I mean, it's not illegal to take prescription drugs if you're prescribed it. But come on.
Well, I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, you've got the lawsuits against Big Pharma, right? And they do go after kind of people who deal in like oxycodone and stuff. But the individual person who's just taking them, I don't know. I think it is illegal for you to try to buy it, which is a big departure from alcohol in the 20s, right? Where it's not illegal for you to go out and try to buy it.
No, it is, because you're not allowed to purchase it, because it's not allowed to be sold.
Does it say that? But sold doesn't say purchased.
They go hand in hand, no?
I don't know. I think we need to investigate that a little bit. I mean, it's an interesting question, right? Does the prohibition on sales mean you can't attempt to buy it? To the best of my knowledge, I don't think they go after people trying to buy it. I mean, they do round up people and take them in the paddy wagon down to the police department.
Well, that's what the whole thing is. They're doing these raids,
right,
to catch people buying it, not necessarily consuming it, although that goes hand in hand too. It's not like people buy drinks and toss them out, but like,
well, what if I buy a cup of coffee and they give me a whiskey for free?
Well, that's what they used to do, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder if that's how mixed drinks became so popular. I don't know.
I think it's why bars served like little crappy food. It's like buy some crappy little pigs in a blanket, and then you can drink all the booze you want for 30 minutes or something.
But then those pigs in a blanket become like the most delicious thing you've ever had.
Well, yeah, I suppose. So the FBI, and we had talked about this in our Prohibition episode. I mean, the FBI for the first time really pays attention to Al Capone after the St. Valentine's Day massacre.
Yeah, again, it's gruesome what happens, right? I can't stress this enough, but it's like the fact that these gang wars are spilling over into like public garages in broad daylight on a holiday of love. I mean, come on. People are just like, hey, let's get a handle on this, huh?
Well, I mean, Chicago already had a reputation, though, at that point. No?
Yeah, for sure had a reputation.
And, you know, I think it's, you know, all the people who had been supportive of social reform via prohibition kind of looked at this and said, the government needs to step in and fix this. This is bad.
Yeah,
right?
It becomes kind of like the poster child for all that's going wrong during the era, right? Mm. I mean, it's like a scapegoat too. It's like, well, Chicago, all these gangs, these immigrants, they're the problem. You know, everything would be going okay if you know, they got a handle on this. And so then there's an immense pressure put on the federal government, which, as we talked about in the last episode, there isn't really an apparatus to enforce prohibition. And so when you start seeing this violence spill out onto the streets, there's an immense pressure put on the federal government to get a handle on this violence spilling out into the community. And again, they just don't have the resources devoted, but then they start to do it because of public pressure.
So we talked in the prohibition episode about this, and I kind of wanted to ask, I mean, do you think anti-Catholicism feeds into this?
For sure. We need to do a whole episode on this. I was talking to a friend who listens, and he thinks that we need to focus a lot on anti-Catholicism in the United States. And I think that it's true. But yeah, I would say most certainly it plays into this.
Because we know it plays into the initial creation of the law. But I just wonder how people shake their heads and say, oh, it's these Catholic immigrants who are doing this. They're kind of ruining this. They're corrupting good law-abiding American citizens who would not be, you know, purchasing this devil juice.
This is this devil juice that they drink at their ceremonies.
Yeah, if it wasn't for these kind of people selling them.
That's really, yeah, no, it's true. I think that that's most certainly a part of it, because we've talked about this so many times, but the Puritan roots in this country, and when we talked about prohibition, I mean, they go hand in hand of like this abolition of alcohol, like trying to just rid society of vice, rid society of prostitution, alcohol, all these different things, right? And it's like, oh, you have these organizations who are comprised of immigrants who are Catholic, who are running all of the bad stuff, all the stuff that goes against this like Puritan ideal. I mean, it's like, it's just, it like goes against everything that these really conservative, socially conservative people had come to this country for in the first place, really.
So let's kind of talk a little bit about what happens to some of the main characters after this. And then we can talk about like the legacy of this and how it changes, you know, the FBI, the Treasury Department, federal government, and even the United States, the public's engagement with kind of the idea of crime and stuff. So Al Capone, he does end up going to jail, right? I mean, he's dubbed, everybody knows he's done it. There is supposedly a dinner where he kind of clubs to death several of his men, although there's strong evidence that that's anecdotal at best. Although it's found its way into kind of modern retellings of the story. But newspapers call him public enemy number one. The FBI really doubles down. He was charged in 29 carrying a concealed weapon, goes to jail for 9 months and was released on good behavior. February 31, he's charged again, has to serve 6 months in the Cook County Jail. So you can see they're after him about everything, right? I mean, it's first this concealed gun, and then it's this contempt charge in a court hearing. All this while, Special Agent Frank Wilson and this unit within the Internal Revenue Service are putting together a case. And by June of 31, he's indicted for evasion, federal tax evasion, income tax evasion. And this is what's hilarious, right? How they get him.
That's always the big joke, right? Like, oh, what did Al Capone go to jail for? It's tax evasion.
Well, it's tax evasion on the money he made selling alcohol, bootleg liquor.
He made so much money selling that bootleg liquor. I want to go back really quickly, though, to his nine-month jail sentence.
Oh, yeah.
So he's arrested in 1929 for concealing weapons, and he's arrested in Philadelphia. He serves 9 months in the Eastern State Penitentiary. And for my research, I do a lot of – that's my spot. That's my prison. Not really. I actually started a lot of my dissertation research on the Eastern State Penitentiary, but then it shifted to Virginia. But I spent a lot of time in the archive there. And if you can go tour it still today, it's still standing. It's a museum and an archive. And you can see his cell. And it's really neat because the man was treated like a celebrity, because he was. His cell had like a beautiful rug in the middle of it. He had a really nice writing desk. He had a radio. He just had like, it was like a luxury cell. And they set that all up for him. I mean, again, the guy's making $60 million a year. Like, he can afford to like pay off guards and stuff like that. But the guards themselves, it's clear that they're sort of struck by his celebrity. And so he spends 9 months there. He spends 9 months listening to records and corresponding with friends and, you know, paying off the guards. He gets to wander around more than everybody else. Like, he gets all this special treatment, basically, in Eastern State Penitentiary. And you can go and still see that today. I would recommend it. The tour is really great. It helps keep the museum, you know, in business and all of that. But it kind of goes to show, like, he was well known. He was considered a celebrity of sorts. And I think we nowadays, we really romanticize him. But even at the time, you know, he was being treated differently than all the other prisoners.
Well, I mean, that's a great point, right? Is this idea that, and it's going to get worse, right? In the Depression, what we're going to see is there's this valorization of criminals that takes place. And they go back kind of in American history and start valorizing people like Jesse James. But then there are all these people, John Dillinger, there are these people that kind of get valorized in the public imagination, even Al Capone to some sense, right? He's a celebrity. When he goes to jail the first two times, he gets sentenced to 11 years in prison for federal tax evasion. First, he serves in Atlanta, and then he's moved to Alcatraz. And, I mean, he gets released in 1939, which is far short of his sentence, but because he's sick, and he eventually dies in Florida in 1947. What he dies of is a little up for debate, but he's a very sick man, right? Now, is it a sexually...
Didn't he die of syphilis?
Well, does he or doesn't he? I don't think it says that on his death certificate.
And
I mean...
I think he died of syphilis.
I mean, sure, right? But again, I mean, maybe social mores are changing yet again at by 47, right? Maybe the stuff that made people love him through the Depression is going away by 47. Maybe you know, how the public responds to Al Capone is a good litmus test to shifting moral values.
Well, he dies not in obscurity, but like people kind of stop caring about him. It is this weird period where he's valorized for the first time in the 1930s, like you said, during the Depression. Then the war comes along and it really changes things, changes society. People come back. And by the time he dies, I think that they don't really care. And then it's not until several decades later that we start to like valorize him. And we have all this nostalgia about the 1920s gangsters and all that kind of stuff. But when he dies, yeah, I mean, there's a definitely public sentiment has shifted toward him, wouldn't you say?
When he dies, public sentiments, I think, shifted behind him, right? I think when he gets sentenced to jail, public sentiment's very much for him. I think people really care about him. But once he kind of dies, I think a lot of people ask, in 47 when he dies, they're like, wait, what? He just died? I thought he died a long time ago.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though, is he died in somewhat obscurity. People had kind of forgotten about him. And I would say it's because World War II is happening and they're just like, yeah, that 1920s stuff, like, we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I also think the war creates I mean, it's an interesting thing. These organized crime guys are kind of viewed as heroes on some level in the 30s. And I think after World War II, I mean, we have people who actually did things that weren't illegal, that people can valorize, right?
We can have that debate another time.
Well, I mean, we can.
The things that they did being legal or
illegal. Well, we will, because it is the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II this year. And we'll be having a couple of episodes about it, right? We're going to talk about a few things.
Most certainly.
In August, we are going to do some stuff on the atomic bomb. Definitely.
Not to be confused with the subatomic machine gun.
Not to be confused with the subatomic machine guns, which, wow. No wonder Capone rules there for a little while.
Where did I get that?
Yeah. I thought it was great. But so I think it's good you bring up this idea that the stuff goes away for a while and then eventually comes back, right? So we get some really shitty movies made. Have I cursed before on our podcast? Oops. So this movie's hilariously bad. I suggest everybody check it out.
Don't say it. Don't say what I think you're going
to
say.
It's on Prime Video to rent.
No.
I don't think it's anywhere free to stream. gather some of your friends and rent it because it's so bad. So Roger Corman in 1967 makes this movie called The St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Oh, okay, okay.
Oh, it's so bad.
I thought you were going to say The Untouchables.
We're going to get to The Untouchables.
Okay. I'm not That's a good one. That's a good one.
But let me, I wanted to read Roger Ebert's review, part of it, because it's so, so the late Roger Ebert did a review of this in 1967. He gave it 1.5 stars.
Yes. Oh. 2 thumbs down.
And the stuff he says is so funny. But he says the antique cars bring up another disappointment. So evidently they tried to make these antique cars that were realistic. Corman allegedly spent hundreds of thousands of dollars constructing sets that would resemble Chicago in the 1920s. What they resemble most of all are Chicago and the gangster movies of the 1930s, right? Which is the thing. It's, I think this is a public perception thing. People today think Chicago in the 1920s looked like 1930s Chicago, gangster movies set in Chicago in the 1920s. They assume it's a 100% accurate reflection. And what was the other one he said? He says that 20th Century Fox didn't take Corman seriously. They just kind of wanted something that would be fun and a little bloody. What Corman does, he tries to make a serious movie. So it's like this weird semi-documentary film. And here's the greatest thing. The voiceover is provided by the same guy who does the ghost host in Disneyland's Haunted Mansion.
Only you would dig up this obscure fact and somehow bring up Disneyland in a podcast about Al Capone. And I respect that.
It was pretty easy to get to it. But I mean, you've got this crappy movie that's made. So Jason Robards plays Al Capone. It's so bad. So very, very bad. It's kind of one of those movies too, where the massacre doesn't happen until almost the very end. And you spend the entire thing waiting for the massacre to happen. It's like Titanic. Oh, it's like all this weird background thing, and they're trying to kind of play up the conflict between Moran's gang and Capone's gang. It's just so, ugh.
So I did say I was going to go back really quickly. And is this what they're talking about, where there was like a lot of attempts on killing one another prior to the massacre itself, right? So the guy who was in charge of the Chicago outfit, Johnny Torrio, they tried to assassinate him in 1925. Do they go back that far?
Yeah, they do. Does it go all the way back to 25?
Well, after there was an assassination attempt on him in a restaurant in 1925. And after that, he moved back to Sicily and was like, I'm done. And hands over the Chicago outfit to Al Capone. And is like, I'm retiring because they're seriously after me. I mean, the gang war goes back. And I mean, it's serious of like trying to take out the head guy. And they're not successful. The Northside gang's not successful in that assassination attempt. I think they kill his driver when they do that. But I mean, when you say it was planned out so well, I mean, it was. And I'm assuming it was like years in the making where they're just trying to find the perfect opportunity to take out the head guy.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't want to watch this horrible movie, but I was wondering if that's maybe what they were hinting at, that it's so deep.
Right. I think maybe. I want to shift to a movie that I think is one of my favorite movies, and I try to watch it every Valentine's Day.
Stop it. You watch it every Valentine's Day?
Some Like It
Hot. What movie?
Some Like It Hot.
Oh. I've never seen 1959. It.
1959. Marilyn Monroe, Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon. It's two guys, musicians who witnessed the St. Valentine's Day massacre and have to dress as women and join an all-girls jazz group and go to Florida.
I had no clue what the plot of that film was.
It's great.
No clue.
It's so fantastic. There it is. If you've not seen that movie, you need to pause the podcast and you just need to go watch that movie. Like, honestly.
Does that mean I'm dismissed from the rest of the podcast?
I mean, this is the great Billy Wilder. This is the guy who did Double Indemnity. Oh, wait, he doesn't do Double Indemnity. He does Sunset Boulevard. What else?
I hate that movie.
You hate Sunset Boulevard?
God, it's awful. So we've had this conversation a lot, and maybe we can have a podcast about what a rube I am. I hate classic movies. I think they're awful. I don't like them. I don't appreciate them. Name one that you think I would like, and I'll tell you I don't. I promise.
What about... that hurts my soul a little bit.
I know. Well, we've talked about this so many times because... you've always wanted me to like put classic movies into my classes. And sometimes I do, like I'll show Tora when I'm teaching Pearl Harbor. I mean, there are things that like I will include as being like not primary sources, but kind of, right? Like they're like cultural moments and I do understand their importance. I appreciate them for that reason. I will never watch a classic movie for pleasure. I just won't do it. Frank made me watch Sunset Boulevard and I was just like,
does he
this
like
is
it?
Insane. Yeah, he likes all that stuff.
Frank and I should hang out a lot. We I both know. Like Star Wars and classic movies.
Yeah, you guys are both weird.
I just checked. He did direct Double Indemnity. My brain did not fail me. He just Stalag 17, Sabrina, 7 Year Itch.
I've not seen any of those. None of them.
The Apartment?
No.
Then he does some crappy stuff towards the end of his life, like The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which is just not good. Kind of sounds like an adult film.
Maybe I.
but sick. I mean, it's so I, honestly, connecting this movie with the St. Valentine's Day Massacre is a little thin. It is technically in there and kind of gangsters are all in it. But the funny thing is this is 59. This movie's comes out. And there's still a little nostalgia about the gangsters. I mean, the gangsters are kind of bad, but there's a couple of them are kind of lovable bad, which is an interesting thing. I mean, 59, we're coming off kind of the optimism of the 50s. You know, the Corman movie is in the late 60s. So it's in a time that's pretty separated from that kind of post-war optimist period. And then we get to the movie you mentioned, right?
Well, that's in the 80s. But, I mean, is it fair to say, though, that there was kind of a love affair between Hollywood and the gangsters because these people had so much money? And there was a lot of wasn't there, like, some overlap?
Like, in the 30s?
Yeah, like, with some of these people who were just starting out and stuff, or no?
Maybe.
Am I wrong?
Maybe. I mean, it's interesting because I think what you could do is you could plot kind of moments where we seem a little more willing to kind of look at positive imagery of gangsters. So The Untouchables is from 1987. You're not supposed to like the gangsters, right? Would you agree?
In The Untouchables?
In The Untouchables.
No, you're supposed to like the federal...
Yeah, you're supposed to like Elliot Ness and all of them. You're not supposed to like the gangsters, right? Because you've got, especially some of them, like Frank Nitti, some of them are just these vile people, right? I mean, you're supposed to be happy when Frank Nitti gets thrown off the roof.
Right, right.
And I think that contrasts with another movie that is thinly veiled reference to Al Capone, which is 1983 Scarface, which is a reimagining of Al Capone's story. Surprisingly enough, directed by the same guy who does The Untouchables. It's an earlier film. So Scarface is 1983, Untouchables is 87. Both of them are based on Al Capone a little bit. One doesn't pretend it's not, but Scarface definitely does, right? And it's the story of Tony Montoya, who is a Cuban criminal who arrives in Miami along with all these Cuban refugees. And he becomes kind of the head of this crime gang, right? This syndicate. It's based around cocaine, right? So it's not around alcohol, because that wouldn't make sense in 1983.
It never made sense in 1920, but
all right, well, but I mean, the interesting thing is this, you're kind of supposed to like Tony Montoya a little bit, especially at key points in the movie.
Oh yeah, we romanticize. And that movie itself has become...
He's so violent and vile.
Oh, is yeah, absolutely terrible.
You know, it's interesting, you know, from 83 to 87, we get these two very different views, right? Al Capone, bad guy. Tony Montoya, maybe not a bad guy. Or maybe just a guy making it in America or something, doing what it takes. I mean, you know, is Gordon Gekko of Wall Street the modern gangster?
Well, he's a bad guy, but we like the bad guy, right? I mean, we know, like, oh, what he's doing is bad, but, like, that's why it's good, you know? And, I mean, so I'm going to go back really quickly to this thinking about Hollywood and celebrity and the gangs and the mafia and all that stuff. I mean, by the 1950s, you have the Rat Pack, right? Mm-hmm. Who Frank Sinatra is like notoriously involved with the mob and Chicago outfit and going to Las Vegas and all that. I mean, I think there's definitely overlap because those people had money. They had like so much money and they're just like running in the same circles, right? It's like George Carlin would say, like, it's a big club and you're not in it, you know? There's all these people with money are running around with each other and they... It's kind of glamorized. It's all a part of that glamour. And the big part of that, there's the gendered component of it. It's not just alcohol. It's prostitutes, right? I mean, these gang members and these, you know, mafia organizations and stuff, like it's like they're running prostitutes just like they're running alcohol. And after Prohibition, that creeps up big again. And who's, you know, they have like high-end prostitutes and all this kind of stuff. Like it's, I think that there's a much deeper, broader connection from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, right? Like there's a lot of overlap, even though the eras are different and the things that are being sold or illegally traded or whatever are different. There's definitely, I would say, the common thread of that there's celebrity involved and it's romanticized because of the amount of money involved.
Well, I mean, maybe right there is kind of the solution to kind of this romanticization of organized crime and stuff is pointing out, okay, like running booze is a victimless crime, right?
I mean,
apart from shooting your competitors.
I was going to say, apart from like lining people up in a garage
right.
and murdering
right. them. But yeah. I'm saying the process itself is supposed to be victimless, right? Whereas these other things that organized crime gets involved in are definitely not victimless crimes.
Oh, no. Right? And how do we – so thinking about it, not just gossiping about Al Capone, but like how do we as historians kind of – make peace with or remedy the fact that it's romanticized, but also people were very mad about it. And it does create this expansion of the federal government. It does create a heightened police state. It does bolster law enforcement. How do we reconcile those things where like in popular culture, it's something that is looked at as like, oh, that's so cool. But at the time, people were upset with the mob. People felt, you know, that there was religious, like we talked about, ethnic. There was a lot of prejudice, you know, not everyone was romanticizing this. And so how do we remedy, like, how does that happen, right? How does it go from we're mad at these Italian Catholics to like, oh, there's a poster of Scarface on somebody's wall on a college dorm in 2020, which I've seen, right? Or I've seen Al Capone's picture, right? Like his mugshot. I say it all the time, like with my cat, like, say hello to my little friend.
Say hello to my little friend. Right. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, have Americans always been fascinated by criminals?
I would argue yes. I mean, I've done work on that in the 19th century, thinking about like penny presses and dime novels and crime. Like, oh, absolutely. We've been we are totally obsessed with it. But how, like I said, how do we reconcile like those two prominent themes that run through American society that are so antithetical?
One of the things I think we do is, as historians, one of the main things that I find myself doing often is deromanticizing things for students.
You know? Yeah.
And I think that we kind of talked about how everybody was, you know, back before New Year's, were like, I can't wait for 2020 because it's going to be like the 1920s. They were so glamorous and everything. It was like, really? Glamorous? Really? They were? I mean, I guess if you were from a particular social economic class at a particular place at a particular time, sure. But for most people, I don't think it's a time they would care to return to.
When people ask me if I'd ever want to live in the past, my answer is always no. There's no part of the past that I am interested in living with. I mean, yeah, to be honest, right now is not great either, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm not willing to give up the stuff, like the things I'm used to.
Running hot water, get out of town, of course. Like, yeah, I mean, all the things. Flushing toilets, come on.
Well, my easy solution is, if it's any time before penicillin, no.
I would be dead. But I wouldn't have made it out of infancy. I would have 100% been infant mortality rate.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. No.
I wouldn't have made it.
I
wouldn't be doing the podcast. I would be the town crier at the time.
On-demand internet? Don't care for
it. No Netflix? I'm out of here.
What did we do before Netflix? It was funny. I was having a conversation with some colleagues the other day. It's like, I mean, we get used to these things very quickly. So this nostalgic view of the past, the further we get from it, I think it's easier to do it. And I think we're so 100 years from the 1920 now. And I think people look back on it and you're like, those gangsters weren't all that bad. They were kind of fighting for their communities. No, they weren't. These are greedy men who saw an opportunity to make a buttload of money.
And exploit their communities. So that's what I would like to say, though. It's like, initially, they're like, oh, you know, we're trying, we don't trust law enforcement, we want to protect our community. It's like, no, you're exploiting your community now. You're not doing anything to help. Holy true. But we continue to make content that glorifies it. I mean, Boardwalk Empire, if you've seen that series.
Oh, yeah. HBO. Well, I mean, what's the Peaky Blinders?
I really like that show.
People love that show, but it is glorifying crime.
Not in the United States, so.
Okay, so it's okay.
Yeah. But it's the same time period with the same undertones. And yeah, and the same, there's the same ethnic and class and, you know, all those prejudices that are going on.
Well, I mean, how many high schools have casino night?
Do they do that?
Yeah, don't they?
I thought that was just an episode of The Office that was inappropriate.
No, they do it. And all the girls dress in flapper costumes and all the boys dress like gangsters. And isn't that
what
fun?
What high school are you talking What high school did you go to that this is happening? We had Great Gatsby.
I know that.
We had to practice dance the
Charleston.
That's
a whole other bad thing. Like anybody who celebrates. Anybody who celebrates that novel didn't read the whole thing. Like, no, I don't mean celebrating it as being not good. I mean celebrate, like, bad stuff happens in that book.
Well, yeah, it's not.
A lot of bad stuff. It is a warning. It is not an homage. Jay Gatsby is not supposed to be a person you want to be.
Tell that to high school literature teachers, though, because they are really jazzed on the book. And I use jazz.
Pun intended.
Pun intended.
Pun intended.
Yeah. Remember when we started this and I was like, oh, there's no way we're talking for an hour.
Here yeah.
We are, 58 minutes.
Well, we went on our cultural excursion through Hollywood film.
This was probably the most unprofessional podcast we've ever done. I apologize for that.
I don't know. I think we brought up some.
You were cursing. Points. I was talking about hating classic.
I said one curse word.
I'm just saying. You have to give me a list of films that I need to watch, and I'm asking listeners to go on our Instagram, comment, tell me what films I need to watch, and I will watch them, and we can start talking about.
But the whole
thing, if you're talking about that.
If you're miserable with them, you shouldn't watch them, though.
Yeah, but it's kind of like how I don't like drinking wine, but I feel like I need to be classy.
No. Oh, Lord. No.
You know what I mean?
I do, but at the same time.
Oh, my God. I love Sunset Boulevard over a glass of wine or something, you know, and I can't do either.
Sunset Boulevard, great film.
All About Eve. Casablanca. Oh, great God, film. I hated that movie.
Casablanca, great film.
Hated it.
Citizen Kane, great movie.
No. What was the one I watched for? What was that one? It's so classic, and people got so mad at me that I didn't like it. It's the one about the bomb.
Oh, Dr. Strangelover. How I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb.
Oh, that was horrible.
Good. That movie's so good. Oof. Oh, it's so good. Anyway. Definitely send your comments for Hillary about what movies you think she should watch. If you don't like them, you don't like them.
I blame my generation.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's sometimes I have students watch for a couple of my classes, a couple of films on their own, and they're almost always like, that's so boring. It just dragged on and on.
You know what movie I hate? It's The Wizard of Oz. Oh, God. I hate that movie. I think it's the production quality that bothers me.
It's so good for its time.
See, and that's what I don't like to hear. It's so good for its time. Well, it sucks. Now, it sucks.
I don't know. Does it? So any last words on organized crime? Al Capone, St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Well, I think that it would be interesting to look into why we're so – I would like to continue to think about public memory, because that's like part of our podcast. We say that we talk about that. But to go into like why are we so interested in crime? I mean, we can talk about this in so many different facets at different periods, because it's still that way. I mean, if you look around – like Netflix, I mean, the true crime thing, it's craze. I mean, it is a total craze. And so I'm interested in that. And I think that I'd like for us to reflect on that, about our obsession with
bad guys. Like right now.
Yeah, right now. And I mean, yeah. And our continued obsession with the 1920s and 30s and organized crime. Because if you think about the people at that moment, they weren't obsessed and crazy and thought it was cool. Most people were upset by it. But then
1939, Roaring Twenties. There's this movie that comes out called Roaring Twenties, which is a real, it's a classic gangster movie. It may be the quintessential gangster movie. And it kind of valorizes these three guys come back from World War One, and, you know, one of them ends up a mob boss. So I think the valorization starts pretty quickly. I don't think it's coincidental that most of the valorization kind of peaks during the Great Depression, because I think the system and anything related to the system seemed to be failing so miserably at that point that anybody who fought against the system was automatically more likable.
Kind of like a Robin Hood sort of thing.
Well, it's Robin Hood. I mean, you get the peak of this with like 1960s with like the Bonnie and Clyde film, right? I mean, based on real people, right? This idea that, you know, they may have done some bad things and stuff, but they were fighting against the man. So that means something. But again, I'll just go back to my earlier statement. I mean, don't forget, Al Capone is not the man giving charitably to orphans, right?
He is not.
This is a brutal mob boss.
It's a brutal mob boss who is exploiting women, who is punished for that by contracting syphilis and dying.
That's because that's how the universe works.
I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence.
Well, I mean, this has been interesting, and I think we could go on about this, but let's kind of save some of our public history stuff for We're going to be talking a lot about public history over the episodes this coming year, I think. Public memory, how you do public history. Anytime you're looking at kind of an event that's been demonized or valorized at various points, there's a good opportunity to talk about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, and we have so many of these moments coming up with it being 2020. I don't know. It does, being the start of the decade, creates a space to be talking about what happened last decade and the decade before that and all. So yeah, there's a lot to talk about, but thank you for joining us today. This was a fun one. Sorry, we've been out for a few weeks. There was technical difficulties and all that, but I'm hoping we'll be on a more regular schedule now.
Yeah. Make sure you join us next time on An Incomplete History. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.